Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Annie Prue, whose latest novel is That Old Ace in the Hole. Earlier novels include Accordion Crimes, Postcards, Shipping News. Annie Prue, you began writing fiction fairly late in life. Before that, you were a freelance writer.
Right.
And you've said that you think that's pretty much the best idea because you can't really write unless you've got experience.
Some people can write, but I think it helps to have experience. For somebody as clumsy and as awkward with writing as I often am, it's good to know a little bit about the human species ways and means and how we all operate, how we feel about things, the sorts of things that can happen. So, yeah, experience and travel and languages and books and communication with fellow inhabitants of the earth I find to be very useful background for writing.
Did you find the switch into fiction extremely difficult? I understand that you hadn't been thinking much about writing fiction prior to writing it.
I did nonfiction magazine journalism mostly for 19 years before I started doing the fiction. And I always wrote one or two short stories each year. And that was my goal, the pinnacle of something or other. And so when I finally decided to do the fiction full-time, it was more of a relief, a breath of fresh air, like climbing into a warm bath after being out in the cold, simply because it's easier for me to write fiction, to be able to invent things instead of fact-checking constantly back and forth and calling up people that you've interviewed and say, did you really mean to say such and such and such, you know, and being very careful about all the bits and pieces. Fiction was great. You know, you could make the characters march or run or lie down or scream or whatever.
And you're not stuck with real people. You create the people you want to create.
Right, exactly so.
Annie Prue, let's talk a little about your most recent novel, That Old Ace in the Hole. It takes place in the panhandle of Texas and Oklahoma, veering back and forth between the two. You've said you've driven through it often.
Right.
But we drive through a lot of areas often. What prompted you to focus in on it?
In the driving through often, I always went on back roads. And you see a lot more on back roads. I'm not an interstate driver unless it's absolutely vitally necessary. So in driving back and forth for over a decade through the panhandles on the back roads and dropping down from the high northeast corner of New Mexico into the panhandle of Oklahoma and onto the Texas panhandle, I was always interested in the collapsed buildings, the old houses going to rack and ruin, obviously wind-whipped, their roofs sunken, shingles littering the yard, cottonwood trees broken with branches all over, and almost always a windmill face down in the dirt in front of the house. And these things just caught my eye, and I thought about them a lot and wondered what kind of story there was behind the abandonment. Later on, I discovered that a lot of them dated back to the 1950s and the 1930s when the area was a dust bowl. Somewhere along the way, the idea of writing about this country was sizzling in the back of my mind, and finally one day I just decided to find out more and proceed.
And the original idea was to have a windmill repairman as your main character?
Yeah, the windmills were so important in the settling of the panhandle, and it seemed to me that a windmill installer and repair person would be a very good peg for a story of the region. And when I started doing my research, it became apparent I knew bloody nothing about windmill repair. So I thought I would have to learn a great deal more. And I read in an instruction manual for windmill repair in the final pages that there was a very good course given in windmill repair at University of New Mexico in Las Cruces. So I called the university and explained my situation, said I wanted to take the course. I was greeted by this huge silence on the other end, and then the voice squawked, "What?" I explained again, and there was smothered laughter, and the person said, "Oh, well, that course hasn't been taught since the 70s. And there I was without a course in windmill repair. So I resorted to windmill repair persons around the panhandle. And I didn't get very far with that. A couple of people stood me up. I was going to follow them around and observe. I did go out with one or two persons, and one of them nearly dropped a wrench on my head. The wrench fell in the weeds, and I had to retrieve it and climb up the tower to give it back. But at that point, I realized I couldn't have my major character be a windmill repairman. I simply didn't know enough. Time was passing by. I had to get this book finished. So I made him a secondary character and the protagonist, a young man who takes on a job as a scout for hog farm sites, moved into the story. And that's more of a contemporary problem anyway. The windmill repair era was the 40s and 50s and 30s and 20s.
Bob Dollar spends most of the book trying to get to see exactly what a hog farm is like, and he never quite gets there. Does that reflect Annie Prue's search for a hog farm?
Yeah, you don't just drive up to the gate, knock on the door, and say, "Let me see your hogs." It isn't that easy. They are behind chain link fences, many of them. They are guarded. There are guard towers and so forth, because in the past there have been all sorts of people coming in with cameras and films, and later the material is used to denounce them. But also because hog farms are very, very careful about admitting germs. The animals live in a germ-free environment, and apparently people who do go in have to take showers and don protective clothing and bubble masks and gloves and all that sort of thing, which wasn't very appealing either.
I had read about hog farms and how horrible they are, and this kind of confirmed it makes you not want to eat pork.
Yeah, well, there is specially raised pork that's where the animals are outside and who live a relatively free organic life. But yeah, for the large part, it does make you not want to eat pork. I've seen films, and I've certainly smelled the hog farms, and I've seen them from the air, but it does put you off.
I take it that the smell and the sickness surrounding a hog farm is well-researched.
Actually, I don't think there are that many solid scientific studies on illnesses. There are a lot of people saying that they get terrible headaches and allergic reactions and all sorts of miseries connected with the overpowering smell and the effluvia. But it's hard to find serious scientific studies.
That old Ace in the Hole has a strange structure, which is that we have Bob Dollar, and he kind of veers through town, and he's got his own story. But there are also these little character studies of characters who may or may not play a role in the book itself.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Some of the Franck ancestors, people who came into the panhandle earlier, are in there, and probably the book didn't need them to move the story along. They're in there partly because I liked the characters and because I also wanted to give a sense of the history of the panhandle, which I found a very, very interesting place as far as events and occurrences that make up what we think of as the history of the whole country. A lot of it started and developed in the panhandle.
When you're obviously doing this kind of research, and not every author does it, but it does come up with those who research to the degree that Annie Prue researches, there's a danger almost in putting in too much research so that the reader can get bogged down. How do you avoid that? Do you cut and cut and cut afterward?
No, I'm not sure I do avoid it. I'm sure there are lots of parts where readers do get bogged down and fling the book aside and say, "I can't read any more about whatever it is under discussion." But that sort of thing interests me, and I hope and assume that it will certainly interest at least most readers. It's not a question of having everything there and then cutting and cutting and cutting. My problem is that I have notes, millions and millions of pounds of notes, and I don't use them all, so a huge amount of material just never goes in at all.
What do you do with the material afterwards?
I put it in a large box and label the box, and it goes in the attic.
So if at some point you could always pull out and say, shipping news, and then you look and go, oh, my God, this is a great piece of information. Wish I'd included it.
Yeah, but I'm not going to open those boxes again. When I'm done, I'm done. Time for new territory.
That old ace in the hole has several great characters. Obviously, Bob Dollar, who's a very distinctive character. Now, he's a young man of 25 years old, kind of a drifter. One reviewer characterized him as a swindler, but I didn't perceive that at all. I mean, he's more of a drifter who's just following along on a job.
Yeah, he's also a little liar, though. He does invent this totally false cover story, which he comes to believe that he's really seeking sites for luxury retirement homes.
He's not a very good liar, though.
No, he's not. He's not.
His uncle collects plastic jewelry. Did you do research on that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, art plastic, which is an acquired taste. And, yes, his uncle and his uncle's partner do collect this art jewelry of all sorts. But they're not limited to it. They also go in for umbrella handles and eyeglasses, purses, and shoes, all made of the finest plastics, of course.
When you're constructing characters, how much are they based on real people? And I'm not talking here about Bob or his uncle or his uncle's partner, but the people like LaVon or Ace or some of the other characters, more idiosyncratic characters running through the towns of that old Ace in the Hole?
Really not at all. They're not based on real human beings. They're really an amalgam of the traits of many, many, many people that one sees in the course of a lifetime. And I keep notebooks all the time, so I will be filling in at odd moments character sketches, the way people walk, facial expressions, clothing, mannerisms, that sort of thing. And when I come to construct a character, I can just go through those notebook pages and put together an assembly of characteristics that make a character that seems to fulfill the role I need in whatever I'm writing, and drawing big X's through those parts.
You created a rather nasty character of the sheriff, and
he's not nasty. He's just a little odd.
You spent a lot of time creating him, and then he just kind of barely comes on the scene. When you were creating him, were you planning to use him more, or did you not know, or what?
Actually, there was going to be another scene with the sheriff, which didn't evolve, but he did have his place in the end with the wrap up of the villainess with her 44 shooting various lovers and so forth.
Who doesn't really come on screen at all?
True. Well, that's what life is like. There are a lot of things going on in the background and behind the scenes that we never get to see up front, but that have their effect.
Annie Prue, the characters may be fiction, but they all have histories, and I'm curious how much the histories themselves are based on real histories.
No, that's all invented. They're probable. They might have occurred to real people at some point in some place. They didn't occur to anybody, as far as I know, in the panhandle.
When you're writing this, are you focusing in on character, or are you focusing in on style? How does that work? Which comes first?
I don't know. I can't really answer it. I guess it's more or less the story, and I do enjoy writing characters, though. I like taking a piece of blank paper and a pen and making a creature rise up from the pages.
You're listening to an interview with Annie Prue, whose latest novel is That Old Ace in the Hole. I have a quote from you I'd like you to talk further about. You say, I always place my characters against the idea of mass, whether landscape or crushing social situations. What do you mean by mass?
Well, exactly that. The landscape, the mass of landscape, that is, when I start doing the research, I start with geography and the climate, the direction of wind, prevailing weather, natural resources, when humans first came into the region, what they started doing, what sort of work came from what was there originally, if you can find something that is originally. After a while, when I finished with that, the story and the characters themselves seem to fall directly out of the landscape. They are shaped by what's around them. Even the food they eat is related to the region, what grows there because of climate and so forth. As for the crushing social circumstances, that played a very big part in the shipping news and the beginning of the failure of the cod industry and the fishing for Newfoundlanders. And in the case here in the That Old Ace in the Hole, it's the incursion of hog farms into the region and the beginning failure of the Oglala Aquifer, which is a very disturbing development. So, you know, what's happening? What's being played out is against this backdrop of both geography and the rural situation.
The Oglala Aquifer plays a major role underneath the story, both figuratively
right.
and literally.
Quite so.
Because when it disappears, now that this is kind of this spongy liquid, it's not really a lake. It's
right.
It's kind of a, I guess, a clay-like substance.
It's gravel saturated with water, and it's immense. And at one time, people believed that the Oglala could never, ever, ever be exhausted, the same way people thought that the pine woods of Michigan's UP, Upper Peninsula, could never, never, never all be cut down. I think it took 30 years. And the Oglala, which was considered to be infinite and inexhaustible, and people only really started seriously tapping into it for agricultural irrigation in the late 1950s, early 60s, and it's half gone.
What happens when it goes?
That's a very good question. It's back to dry farming in some parts of the panhandle that lie over the Oglala now, because there's a point reached where it doesn't become worthwhile economically to pump the water up from many, many, many hundreds of feet down. You use so much fuel in pumping the water up, and the return is so marginal on the crops that it doesn't pay. So I don't know what happens then. I guess everybody comes to the West Coast and becomes a politician. Hey?
What is dry farming?
Where you get in communion with the one above and pray for rain. That's it. No irrigation.
Annie Prue, there's political elements here. We know that these folks are generally, we hear about them as being right-wing Republicans, and yet they're very anti-corporate.
People in rural places have very little to say about what happens to them. The decisions are all made in urban and faraway power centers, often by corporations who couldn't care less about the people who are living in the area. In fact, they don't even see the people. They see what's there to be gotten out, whether it's methane gas or oil or water or whatever. So there's a political element in the sense that almost everything is political these days. But
sure.
It's really the rural hinterland against power centers elsewhere. The people in these rural left-alone hinterlands are somewhat victimized, and many of them think of themselves as fiercely independent and leading lives of free choice. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It's because there's space around that gives the illusion of freedom, but really that freedom is not quite definable.
When researching a book like this, it must make you very angry watching these people go through this and understanding how little of it is within their control.
I'm not sure angry is the word.
Discouraged?
Partly, yeah. I would say that's a better word. I was trained as an historian, so I look at myself as an observer. And in writing novels and short stories, I feel myself in an observational position. I really do feel that I'm more of an observer, and that my job, if there is a job, is to line up different sorts of people and attitudes in an area that are braced against or underpinning a situation or an event.
Did you feel welcomed in the panhandle by these people? When I mean, that some of them may have known who you were.
Oh, no.
No?
No. Uh-uh. No, I was pretty anonymous, and I just sort of hung out, and I was here today, gone tomorrow kind of thing, passing through, tourist.
How many towns did you visit?
Oh, I think all of them in the panhandle. I don't think I left a single part of the Texas or Oklahoma panhandle unvisited. I spent a couple of years. It's only 800 miles from where I live in Wyoming, so the trip wasn't onerous. And I could go down for a week or 2 weeks or whatever. I rented a place on the back of a ranch for 6 months at one point in the northeast corner of Texas and lived there while I was gathering information and looking at one thing and another and going to cattle auctions and looking at windmill repairs on the countryside.
Did you read the book that Bob Dollar reads in That Old Ace in the Hole?
Oh, yes, Lieutenant Hebert's report.
Did you actually live in Newfoundland for a time, or did you just go there and visit?
I just went there and visited. I have an old house up there. I get up once a year, so I'm still in Newfoundland every year. But when I was working on the Shipping News, I think I made 10 trips up of various durations, a couple of weeks, a couple of months.
How do you compare the people of Newfoundland to the people of the Panhandle? In both cases, they're isolated rural peoples.
Mm-hmm. They're similar in lots of ways. Most rural people are, in that they're blunt and honest, very hardworking, very cooperative with one another, that they're hard put to it to explain why bad things happen to them that don't seem to happen in other places. They're neglected by governments and local powers as well as faraway powers. And they both have a warmth and generosity of heart that is extremely excellent.
Many of your short stories have unhappy endings, and there's a kind of happy ending to the Shipping News, and your comment about it is that it is ironic. There's a kind of happy ending to The Old Ace in the Hole. Is that equally ironic?
No, it's not so much ironic as it is you fill in the blanks to the reader. I like readers to be participants in a story, so many times I will leave something unresolved or hanging a bit and depend on the reader to complete in their own mind what might have happened there or what should happen, to draw on their own life experience to become a partner in the story, because a book is not finished when the writer is finished with it. The book is only finished when the reader is finished with it, and each reader has a different book in mind, of course.
And you're always aware that there is going to be a reader.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a great respect for the reader, and I think of myself as a reader rather than a writer. Yeah, I depend on the reader, largely, to finish things off, round things up, and fill in blanks.
Are there times where you leave something so ambiguous that you don't know the outcome, but you let the reader figure it out and figure the reader might have a better idea than you?
No, there are times when I'll leave something up in the air and unresolved, but I'll know what it is, but I don't put it in. There is something of that sort in this book. Bob Dollar's landlady, Ms. Frank, has got a photograph of her great-grandfather whose back is all scratched up, and Bob Dollar is dying to know what all of that was about. The man's got a very scarred back. And Levon never tells him, and it's never said in the book, what the scarring was caused by. So it's left up in the air.
But you know what it is.
Yes, I do.
Will you let her?
No, I won't. No, that's the reader's job.
Annie Prue, this book is primarily the Panhandle area, and the last one was Newfoundland. Have you picked a place for the next?
No. No, I'm actually, I've gone back to short stories right now as relief from novel writing. I prefer writing short stories, and when I was working on a collection called Close Range, I had five or six stories I wanted to include in that, but there simply wasn't time to get them into the right kind of shape, and in some cases they remain simply a paragraph or a couple of jotted ideas. So I'm working on those now for a continuation of the close range group of stories.
In dealing with short stories, is it that different for you from dealing with a novel, given that a lot
of you... Yes, totally.
All right. Yeah. How so?
Short stories are more, for me, more like solving a crossword puzzle or something. There's an element of game in them, and there's also a smaller time scale that you're dealing with. I can write a short story in 6 weeks to 2 months, whereas novels take several years. There's a high bar in short story writing. There's a level of difficulty that makes them much more challenging because everything has to be right. Everything has to be in its place. The architecture has to be correct. The sentences have to balance. The whole thing has to have a center of gravity that's quite different from the novel. And they're just, for me, much more pleasurable to write. Just the addition of a phrase can shift the meaning of an entire story because the length is small.
Let's talk for a second about the film of The Shipping News. How did you feel about it?
I felt fine about it. I never expected the film to be the book. Films are films and books are books, and never the twain shall meet. So I wasn't all in a huff, and I wasn't outraged that characters were left out and that things had been condensed and so forth. It was fine with me, and I thought that the film stood on its own legs very well. I know people complain bitterly that Kevin Spacey was not Coyle and didn't look like Coyle. Well, of course he didn't. But he acted like Coyle, and I thought he was very convincing, and I liked what happened.
That was filmed up there, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, the exteriors were all Newfoundland.
So when you saw it, this was in some sense what you visioned.
That's what it looks like, absolutely.
So to that degree, you got pretty lucky.
Uh-huh, I think so. Yeah, I liked it very much. I thought they did it a very good job.
Do you see that old Ace in the Hole becoming a movie?
No, I don't think filmmakers are keen on hog farm movies, at least not yet. So, no, I don't think so.
Annie Prue, in your career, your whole career, you've written a lot of short stories. If you were to recommend a short story you've written, a single one or two, for someone who really wanted to see you at your best, could you pick one out?
Probably the stories in Close Range, the Wyoming stories, are my favorite ones. I liked working on those stories, and I think they came out fairly well. Yeah, that's what I would say, I guess.
You've been listening to an interview with Annie Prue, whose latest novel is That Old Ace in the Hole. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.